Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
Now let's get right on down to the skit. A baby is brought into a world of pits. And if we could have talked that soon in a delivery room, it would have asked the nurse for a hit.
All right, you're hearing a little bit of the soundtrack of the movie Civil War, which is one of the things we're going to talk about today. The other thing being Manhunt, a multi-part Apple Plus series based on a book of history about the search for John Wilkes Booth. So there's some through lines here, and that's why we planned it the way that we did. I'm going to just go out on a limb and say, because, in fact, this the first movie, Civil War, the first thing we're going to talk about, because that's concentrates heavily on the role of photojournalists. So I'm going to say that the Papoulian through line, and physicists now believe there is a Papoulian through line through everything, through all of existence. The Papoulian through line is Matthew Brady. I mean, you know, when you think about it, battlefield photojournalism was invented during the Civil War. I think there's even a shout out to Matthew Brady somewhere in Manhunt. And then we meet his heirs in the movie Civil War. So who's we? Who are we talking about right now? So for the first segment, Tanisha Dugan, associate producer at Octopus Theatricals, Zandra Ellen, producer at Pineapple Street Studios, Frankie Graziano, he's making his nose debut, better known as the host of The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public. We're excited to have all of them here today. And then Matt Warschauer, a great historian, is going to join us for the Manhunt segment, just because history, that's why. We're going to maybe begin, and so Maestro, what I think I'm going to do is drop down to A3 here. We should play a little bit from this movie, Civil War. It's directed by Alex Garland, probably best known for Ex Machina, also the series Devs. Also Annihilation, also a terrific novelist too. The Beach is a really great novel. Anyway, you're going to hear a little bit from the movie Civil War. It takes place in the near future. They're not too specific about it, but somewhere in the near future, the American experiment has collapsed in a way that seems kind of on brand for the present moment, and it has devolved into a terrible civil war. A group of photojournalists are trying to document that. You're going to hear Kaylee Spaney as Jesse, the kind of young pup of the crowd. Wagner Moura as Joel. He's actually a writer and reporter. And then Kirsten Dunst as Lee, maybe the photojournalist who's mostly the biggest focus of the movie. And the great Stephen McKinley Henderson as Sammy. Here goes A3, Maestro.
I didn't take a single photo. I didn't even remember I had cameras on me. Like, oh my God. Like, why didn't I just tell him not to shoot them?
They're probably going to kill them anyway.
How do you know?
He doesn't know, but that's besides the point. Once you start asking yourself those questions, you can't stop. So we don't ask. We record so other people ask. Want to be a journalist? That's the job.
Hey, Lee.
What?
Back off.
What am I saying that's wrong?
I'm not saying it's wrong. She just shook up.
Lee doesn't understand shook up.
Whoa. I'm not being protective of her? You're the idiot who let her in this car.
So I just kind of maybe want to go around the table, metaphorically speaking, and hear how people are thinking and feeling about this. Tanisha Dugan, why don't you get us started? Tell us overall what your experience was like.
I couldn't remember the last time I had been in a movie theater. So this felt fraught and heavy and kinetic to go see a movie about an impending civil war in this moment for this viewer. And I think all of that sort of anxiety and anticipation about like, who's going to be in the theater and what will this experience be like? For me, has had me thinking, but I think had me thinking, not, oh my God, I can't wait to watch this movie again. But thank you guys for sending me to things that I would normally never choose to take myself to see.
Not the first Nose panelist to say something like that, although it's not always framed in the form of a thank you. But yeah, no, I hear you. I will just say, before we go any further, I was terrified all the way through this movie. I saw it at Real Art Ways last evening. I actually think it's a really good movie, but I was mostly thinking I'm going to have a heart attack. I am so worried and frightened by what I am seeing. But Zandra, let's go to you too. Let's hear what you're thinking right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think I had a slightly different perspective. I definitely found this movie like very violent and jarring, and there was a lot of parts of it that were deeply upsetting and scary. But when I left, I felt extremely empty. And I am finding the way that people are talking about this movie to be absolutely fascinating because, and I'm sure we'll get into this, but there's no actual information about what the context of the Civil War is. And so it's really a Rorschach test, right? Where everybody who goes into this film is sort of projecting their own fears or their own, dare I say, fantasies of what a Civil War might look like onto the movie. So, you know, maybe you see the president as a liberal Democrat and the secessionists are kind of Trumpers, or maybe vice versa, or this is speculative fiction of a parallel universe America. You literally don't know. So you're bringing whatever you believe a civil war might look like to your viewing experience, which makes listening to people talk about it so interesting, because I'm hearing people say things that I didn't see in the text of the movie, but that feel like projections of their own fears. So for instance, this is just one example, but the character who plays the president is played by Nick Offerman. And I've heard a lot of people describe him as a Trump-like figure. And what's so interesting is that he's barely in the movie. Like, and in the moments that he's in the movie, I didn't find a lot about that performance that was actually a Trump analog. So it's really interesting that if you're going into this movie from the perspective or with kind of a fear that Trump could foment a civil war, that's exactly what you're going to see. So the movie is really, I think, ultimately, and I didn't love this experience, but I think that what the movie is ultimately doing is that it's designed to illustrate more about ourselves as viewers than it actually has anything to say about war or violence in general.
I mean, I kind of agree with that. I mean, first of all, I think a lot of people just assume Ron Swanson would be a Trump voter, and therefore probably that's what's happening here. But as McPants is pointing out, for example, he did stay for a third term. You know, who do we associate that kind of behavior with? But I also agree. I think ultimately Alex Garland's position is it doesn't matter. We're really just talking about how people behave at this point. And the people coming to shoot the president and the people defending the president, I don't think you can really necessarily at that point assign a lot of moral hierarchy or any kind of good guy, bad guy equation to them. But Frankie, I know this is a thing that you had some questions about as well.
Yeah, I agree with Sandra's assessment there. I think the legacy of this movie is going to be sort of the mental gymnastics that you have kind of in response to it when you watch it. And it probably tells us more about ourselves than it does about what's actually in the movie. Might uncover biases and things like that. Like, I'll give you one example. I shared some of these responses earlier with our colleagues. It's the first time I got to meet them. So maybe they can speak to them a little bit. But one of the things I thought was, you see at the end of the film that the Western Front, they're nice to the journalists, right? They let them in bed with them. And I guess at the end, they're protecting their lives as they're going after the president. And some of our photographers, including the one you heard from earlier, Jesse, are getting very close to the action. They're getting pulled back. So I don't know if you're somebody like me who spends a lot of time being a journalist, and technically the people who sometimes get in my way of doing my job are people that don't necessarily like democracy. That kind of forms a bias. So it told me a lot about myself, the way that I was watching that movie and trying to figure out who's who, who's good, who's bad, that kind of thing. So I definitely think that's the movie's legacy, and I think it was kind of designed in a way. I know I saw some things afterwards, some ways that the movie was covered, and talking about how the Western Front was put together and things like that. And whatever you got from it afterwards, as I think Zandra and Tanisha kind of allude to this, it the movie doesn't necessarily spell it out. Just besides what we see from Jesse Plemons' character with that overt action of killing people and being racist, in that, you don't really see much in terms of giving away the story.
Yeah, I think it's almost axiomatic that Jesse Plemons is going to play the person who really doesn't have any kind of moral compass and is capable of doing anything. That's kind of on brand for Jesse as well. But, you know, I think, Tanisha, this also brings up a question about what this movie is. I don't think it's a movie particularly about how a civil war would happen in America, or even a movie that projects out from the present moment and says, this is what it's going to be like it if it ever really destabilized. I think it was sort of more of a movie about photojournalists in battlefield situations. And the backdrop of this happens to be, and maybe makes it especially poignant, that it's their own country instead of, you know, Syria or someplace that they've been choppered into. But I'd love to get the whole panel's take. And Tanisha, maybe you could go first.
Yeah. You know, I like that viewpoint of it because I think that allows us a different kind of allegory than the one in which we're trying to understand what side of America is going to win this battle we're in. I like the idea that this is a question around photojournalists, but journalism writ large and their participation as the fourth estate. I think that's actually a much more satisfying way to come into this work. And one of the things that I'm curious about, and because journalism isn't my art form, isn't my practice, is what exactly is the role of the journalist in this moment? I think the movie gives us some clues, right? This idea that they are going to get in there and see everything and document everything for us. There's this also opinion, it seems, that there is no point of view within the journalism, which is something that I struggle with, because every viewer, to Xander's point and Frankie's point, every viewer comes to anything with their history, with their background. And I think we're in a moment in our journalism in which we're trying to pretend that there is some kind of level plate neutrality that we're coming to things with that to me is cowardly and untrue. And so, yes, I love this sort of view, this framing that you're offering, that this is a movie that's asking us to sort of look at journalism and photojournalism in particular. And the artist making it is playing this dance of neutrality that feels both resonant in this moment and deeply cowardly to me.
Yeah, I mean, Xandra, just go ahead and react to that.
Yeah, I really appreciate, Tanisha, you bringing up this idea of the kind of like perfectly unbiased journalist and kind of the fallacy of that. Without giving anything away, there are moments of the movie where we watch the journalists leading the action, like actually like leading the fighters to where they need to be, you know, sort of like really being in charge of the narrative and actually crafting the narrative on a certain level, which I think is interesting. I do struggle with, this is another thing where it's just like, it really depends on how you're watching this movie, how you walk away feeling about how it portrays journalists. I've seen a lot of people say that this is a film that really glorifies or lionizes photojournalists. I actually came away from it feeling like it was the opposite. I thought that it was really positioning these people as ego chasers, as deeply self-aggrandizing, reckless in their quest for the perfect shot. And I was a little bit disturbed by that, even though I know that that's not the universal take. I think this is a moment that we're in, and obviously Alex Garland maybe couldn't have known that when he was making the film, but where journalists in general, but particularly war journalists, are really excessively undervalued and really demonized in the field. And so it felt like a bit of a misstep for me, but I know that other people read it completely differently. So I think it's really interesting to hear.
Without having talked to any photojournalists about it, I can't say that it's totally accurate, but just in my viewpoint of working with photojournalists for so long, it seems like it's pretty accurate. Like the resourcefulness that you see in the film. Like I think in one of the scenes, Jesse pulls out some liquid that she had close to her body to keep it warm. The press images on the truck, the vests, everything like that, the equipment, the action, it's pretty on brand. I've gone out and covered a tropical storm with somebody. I was just thinking about our colleague Joe Amon throughout this film. It seems like pretty on brand with photo infernal journalists. That's one. But then there's the other side of the coin, which Zandra is really getting to. And I think about the whole thing we were talking about earlier with the president, right? Looking back at this film, it seems like a lot of people think that this president is a dictator. And I think we've already established that that's what people think. But if you think about the way that the president is portrayed throughout the movie, spend most of the time talking about how he's going to die soon. And that's kind of a problem. Not necessarily because of either way that he falls on the political spectrum, but this says a lot about the reporters here in the movie, the journalists here in the movie. It's more important that he's going to die soon because they got to get a quote from him, because they got to get a picture from him. So as you could think on one side of the coin that maybe they're lionizing journalists here, as Sandra said, but it made me think big picture, like, do we have a bias when it comes to journalists? And then, what are we actually seeing? Like, is the quote the most important thing here? Is that the takeaway?
I mean, one thing that I would say about this is I read a piece, a Q&A with Carolyn Cole. She has a Pulitzer Prize for war photography in Liberia, but she's been like in all of these situations. She had some interesting things to say. She's first of all said there's no universal truth about battlefield or wartime photojournalists. Okay. They're kind of different. She actually was a little bit bothered by the developing fluid at room temperature scene. Frankie, she just said most people are shooting digital. She goes, there's still people who shoot film, but you really do have to have a dark room. You can't do the thing that they show there, at least not in her opinion. But I thought the most cynical stuff, maybe to Zandra's point, there was this little back and forth. They kind of team up for a very short time with some Hong Kong journalists. And there was some talk of, yeah, who's going to get that money shot where the president gets, gets taken out. And that did seem a little cynical. Most of the photographers that I was a newspaper person for the first 20 years of my career. Most of the photographers that I dealt with, the ones who were kind of adrenaline junkies like these people, I mean, you know, to quote from the movie Heat, the action is the juice. You know, they kind of get in it because they can't turn that spigot off anymore. And they don't think about their own safety quite the way most of us probably do. But I never thought of them as amoral. I thought of them kind of trying to tell a story of history. You know, we're going to run out of time pretty fast here, and this is really kind of interesting. But Tanisha, I don't know. I'll just throw this out. One of the things that I was struck by, even though I was terrified out of my mind all the way through this movie, is that I don't think I've seen a movie since Apocalypse Now where war is depicted with a kind of ghoulish beauty. You know, all through this movie, just flames and sparks, and there's so much stuff that is almost kind of painterly. And it's I don't even know how to feel about that when it's really ultimately the depiction of slaughter.
I mean, it is the art of war, right? I mean, there is a specificity and a intention behind the way in which, even as I watch this moment we're in of war, it play out. So it feels both connected and relevant. There was a moment, I can't remember, I was trying to dig in my brain of exactly when, as I sat in the audience and you get a gush, a spurt of blood, and someone in the audience said, "More blood! I want more blood!" Wow. And I thought, "Oh, interesting. Like I'm curious what we're looking for here." I think, you know, I want to just hop into your point about the cynicism of trying to get the shot, and it made me think of Kobe Bryant and the photographers who desperately wanted to seek a photo of him and the rest of the lives lost in that helicopter. Mm-hmm. I think there is something about seeing is believing in this moment. And whatever side the president is on, Frankie, you know, I still don't believe that. I'm not sure we can claim he's a dictator, but, you know, I'll let that one rock. But I think that one.
I don't think so either. I agree with you.
But I think wanting to have that photo for history's sake, you know, to be able to say this was the transition of this country and we were there, and to see the smiling faces of the paramilitary, and to, and for us to look back and go, okay, I wonder what that story is. Who's the, who is the good guy? Who is the bad guy? Because we're always trying to weave a story through these pictures. That feels like the thing, but that may be my artist brain trying to paint a picture around the motivations of these people that may be just this viewer's background.
No, I think you're pretty close. Carolyn Cole, who I mentioned before, one of her quotes is, "My mission has always been to be the eyes for people who can't be there to witness what's happening in person," which I think is a version of what you're saying too. You know, Sandra, we're running out of time here, but I do want to talk about a scene that really jumped out for me. I mean, most of the time, you are seeing them either on the road towards danger or in danger or both at the same time. But there's this little moment where they go into a town that is artificially kind of pacified looking anyway. And the two women, Kirsten Dunst and her protege, go into a dress shop. And Kirsten Dunst, who kind of has been looking doughy and beaten down all the way through this thing, is coaxed into trying on a dress and looking in a mirror. And I found it actually very, very poignant. But I'm wondering what you made of it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think this actually will sort of bleed into my commentary for Manhunt, which is just to say women do be shopping. No, just kidding. But there was a bit for me where I was a little bit like,
Reggie.
Yeah, the women are going to go ahead and be shopping. And we see a little bit of that in Manhunt as well. I think, you know, the framing for that scene for me, I think, was a little bit of just like a life goes on in the midst of war. You know, they walk into this dress shop and they encounter the woman at the counter who's just sort of there very placidly sitting and reading. And they're like, you know, there's like kind of a huge civil war going on outside. I thought that line was a little bit cheesy, but it's sort of to reconcile the juxtaposition of the outside world being at war, and inside this sleepy town, they are not paying attention to it, which I do think is an interesting contrast. I think that something that I really struggle with, which is a little bit like not exactly to your question, is the notion that I was feeling like the entire movie, all of the participants were kind of flattened in such a way where it's like the reporters and the woman at the dress shop and the fighters and the president and all these people were sort of flattened in such a way that they were, there was an erasure of the fact that there are varying degrees of complicity in war, and that the notion that the woman in the dress shop who's ignoring the war and the reporters who are documenting the war, and that just sort of putting them all in the same kind of soup, if that's making sense, and saying like, you know, these people are all kind of on the same level in terms of their culpability in this war, I took some issue with. But I did find that moment to be pretty poignant, I guess I would say.
Yeah, I mean, Frankie, the way that I took the moment too is that in a way, Kirsten Dunst is looking in a mirror at somebody she could have been. I mean, she's chosen this other life where she's going to be dirty and sleeping in her clothes for days at a time and risking her life. But she takes this one little moment. I think she's sort of seeing, oh, this is the me that's living like my family in Colorado who are trying to pretend right now the war isn't happening.
And I think in that scene about Joel, too, walking up and asking the shopkeeper there right when they walk in, about not knowing what's happening outside. I kind of get that as a journalist so much because we talk about certain things and certain topics, particularly around elections, and you're almost shocked when you hear that people aren't talking about it in the same way. So one thing that some of the movie tells me is that one actor, and I'm not talking about the craft, but one actor in life may not be as important as the next person, right? We're all pretty much equal in that regard. So maybe Joel thinking too much about the journalism there and people caring about it, but one person might be thinking more about their own personal safety or their own brain.
All right, let's take a little break and then we'll come back. Dream, baby, dream. Dream, baby, dream. Dream, baby, dream. Forever.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Loneliness can be a significant health risk to people of all ages. Dr. Laura Saunders, a psychologist from Hartford HealthCare's Institute of Living, talks about social isolation and why we need to connect in person.
Loneliness actually is a pretty significant health risk for people that struggle with social isolation. It affects their blood pressure, it affects their immune system, it affects your willingness to get up and get out, and can cause some not just emotional issues, but health problems as well.
You're not alone. Dr. Saunders explains how important it is for us to look to others and get out of our comfort zone.
I like to talk about social isolation as not just that individual's problem, but it's a community problem or it's a family problem. We need to connect with others. We can take space at times as well, but we need to step out of our comfort zone and do things to connect with other people. It's life-saving.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
All right. I realize this is a somewhat jumbled progression that we're doing here, but that's what Pledge does to us. All right. We're back. We're about to talk about Manhunt, a multi-part series on Apple Plus. It has not concluded yet, we should say. It's based on a work of history, Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase for Lincoln's Killer by James L. Swanson. What else do I need to tell you? Well, first of all, that our panel today is Tanisha Dugan, associate producer at Octopus Theatricals. Sandra Ellen is producer at Pineapple Street Studios. And joining us now, very exciting, Matthew Warshauer is an inventor, humanist, and historian. He's a professor of history at Central Connecticut State University. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Creating and Failing the 9/11 Generation, The Real Story of September 11th. I'm really looking forward to this book. Matt told me about it at dinner a few months ago, and I'm psyched. I mean, maybe it's the wrong word, but I'm excited about the book. Maybe before we even get started, we'll let you hear a little of this. It takes place in the aftermath of Lincoln's assassination. You actually do see the assassination of Lincoln. Matt will have some things to say about that. But we'll hear something from episode 2. You're going to hear the immortal Patton Oswalt as Detective Lafayette Baker and Tobias Menzies, who is the undisputed star of this particular series, as Edwin Stanton, Secretary of War, B1 Maestro.
Well, the question is, Booth is one of the most famous actors in the world. You put a huge reward on his head, so why the hell has no one spotted him yet? And the only explanation is that Booth is being protected by the Confederate Secret Service.
Go on.
Well, Booth is being shielded by the Confederacy. Did they have a hand in planning it? I mean, who's his contact? Booth is a stuntman. Who produced his stunt? Was it the Confederacy? Was it Wall Street? Or, hear me out, was it Johnson?
Baker.
Who benefited the most? It was Johnson.
So you're saying that Johnson set up Booth to kill Abe and staged a failed assassination on himself? You sound like Mary Lincoln.
Don't discount Johnson. Everybody's thinking it.
You know, we could, Matt Warshauer, you could probably teach an entire class just unpacking everything that just got said in that one little clip. But maybe we should just start with your perspective as a historian. I'm guessing that you don't want to be the guy sitting on the couch telling everybody, that's not right, that's not right, that's not right. On the other hand, you are a historian and you do know certain things that aren't in a series like this one. I don't know, what was your relationship, I guess, to Manhunt, the way they're telling the story now?
Well, thanks for having me on, Colin. You know what? I love Swanson's book. And I, you know, it's been a while since I taught it in class. And it's just such a great read. My students love it. The series, you know, I do like to be the guy on the couch going, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. But only with a certain select group of people, right? I love the concept that they wanted to do this. The production value that we've come to expect on these kinds of series, you know, it's amazing. The costumery's great, the scenery's great. But this really, in a lot of ways, for some particular reasons, fell very flat for me. And I love Tobias Menzies' performance, but it was so off kilter in terms of what Edwin Stanton, who he really was, that really put me off.
I want to stay with you for just a second about that, because I think it's maybe worth probing what you see as the... We should say that Menzies in this is, his version of Stanton is very heroic, more progressive, I think, on the subject of emancipation and a post-war world, maybe even than Lincoln himself. And somebody seeking justice and putting his own health at risk in the process. I don't know what struck you as maybe not quite right.
He's portrayed as an action figure, right? I mean, he's if you just go and look at a picture of Edwin Stanton, you know, he was not exactly the most athletic guy in the world. He was quite rotund. He had this wicked long 19th century, you know, beard without the mustache. You know, he did accurately have asthma, but they port, you know, this is the CSI, you know, sloop Edwin Stanton, crime show Edwin Stanton. And that's just, you know, Stanton was an incredibly important figure, and he was definitely obsessed with hunting down Booth. There's no question about that. But he did it from a telegraph office. And so this need of the producers and the writers to create the Stanton action figure, I just felt like it was, in a lot of ways, it wasn't necessary. There's so much meat in this story. There's so much meat in Swanson's original manuscript. There's a lot of ways you could have done this that would have been really cool and, in fact, more historically accurate.
Okay, so let's go to the non-historians among us. That would be me, but also Zandra and Tanisha. Zandra, I don't know. Let me just take your temperature overall about this series.
Well, first of all, I just looked up a picture of Edwin Stanton, and I literally gasped. This is definitely not what he looks like in the show. I would say, you know, this is not your classic Zandra Ellen Fair. There aren't a lot of girlies doing stuff, as I alluded to in the prior segment. I did definitely appreciate Mary Todd Lincoln's shopping addiction. That was really kind of a thrill to find out about that. But generally speaking, I felt that it was a little bit drawn out. There was a lot that I felt like could have gone into each episode, and instead it felt like a lot of fluff. It's kind of one of those shows that you watch, and I kind of honestly relish in this, but I love when you're watching a like historical reenactment series with like a gazillion characters, and there's a person who comes on screen for exactly 5 minutes, and it's like, this is your moment, like this is the bit that's gonna go in my reel, and they just give the hammiest performance you've ever seen. They were like, every word is drawn out so long, like, and so there was a lot of that in the show for me, which I find pretty fun, but I did have so many questions from a historical standpoint, particularly around the politics of these two, you know, central men, not Booth, but Stanton and Lincoln, who seem to be making kind of all of the decisions in the show behind closed doors, either just the two of them or with Frederick Douglass. And they seem to be these like real crusaders for post-war equality in a way that I'm not sure how seriously to take that kind of like martyr vision of these people. I tend to approach that with a little bit of skepticism, but I honestly just don't know. So I was really excited to hear the historian.
All right. So we'll in just a second, we're going to circle back to Matt on that one. But yeah, Tanisha, I just want you to go wherever your thoughts are going right now.
I mean, I think my thoughts are going towards, I want to see Matt's version of Manhunt, because I think there's something really interesting about the sort of pre-CIA work the pre-FBI work of what Stanton was essentially doing from a telegraph office. And I think you're right that I think there is this sense that the audience appetite wants something more active, wants to see the chase, that the police have to give chase in order for you to catch the bad guy. I would also agree with Xander that I think that, like, by the time I got to like episodes 4 and 5, they were all getting a little like watery to me, and I was like, wait, did I see this already? Do I need to do I have to go back? Did I miss something? But generally, this is totally my kind of fare, this kind of you know, narrative historical retellings. I do think it's hilarious that they like threw all reality that we can Google to the wind. It's like, let's just ignore what this man actually looked like. Let's find somebody. I love Tobias, but like, he's not an actor that is making people like run to see a piece. So I'm kind of like, huh, why not Patton Oswalt in that role?
Well, yes, this, that
how
point,
did we
yes.
get here?
Patton Oswalt does look a little bit more like Edwin Stanton than Tobias Menzies does.
Right?
I should say, if you don't know Tobias Menzies, think Brutus in the HBO Rome. Think the most mm-hmm. recent version of Prince Philip in The Crown. He was the last Prince Philip in that series. If you saw a picture of him, you'd probably know who we're talking about. But we're going to circle back to Matt and have him maybe help the rest of the panel out with some of their questions about the history. We do have to take a very, very quick break. This is not a pledge break. We'll take a very quick break right now, and we will be right back.
Going down to the river, there's a man I want to see. Yeah, he's the ferry man. He'll recognize.
If you could hear the math we're doing while we're not on the air here trying to figure out how to make this whole thing work. Anyway, I'm doing that math with the maestro, Dylan Ray, our technical producer today. The producer of The Nose pretty much all the time is Jonathan McPants. And we're here with this wonderful panel of Tanisha Dugan, Xandra Ellen, and Matthew Warschauer. So, Matt, some questions were brought up here, and I think Xandra had some pretty good ones about just the relationship between Stanton and Lincoln, the degree to which they plus Frederick Douglass were in a position to try to orchestrate the end of the war, the aftermath of the war. Can you just help us out a little bit with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Lincoln, you know, he's a tricky character, right? He, at the beginning of the war, he is not devoted to the end of the institution of slavery. This is something that develops over time. He was a supporter of trying to end the war, even if slavery existed. He was trying to end the war with gradual emancipation and paying the South. We saw a little bit of that in this Manhunt series. And he was in favor of colonization, of moving free African Americans out of the country. It's not until the middle of the war that he really comes to the realization that this needs to change, and he needs to embrace emancipation as a war measure and as something that is a just cause. And I think that Frederick Douglass helps him along that road. And I think that Edwin Stanton is a big believer in all of this. You know, you can connect Stanton all the way through to the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. So Stanton is unquestionably a super, super important figure in all of this. But, you know, there's volume upon volume upon volume written about this. And before we get away too far away from it, Colin, I just want to make sure we talk a little bit about the assassination scene whenever mm-hmm. you're ready.
Well, do it right now.
All right. So I'm watching, you know, this, I read a little bit about the series before it, you know, I watched it, and they were devoted to historical accuracy. This is one of the things that they said. And they have so many little nuanced pieces to it that they get right. But then I watched the assassination scene, and it's the kind of thing that only a Lincoln nerd would notice. And so I, of course, called Colin, our mutual friend, Doug Levine, who's a Lincolnophile, and I said,
and 3 hours later, Doug stopped talking about this. Anyway, continue.
Right. I don't know. I said, Doug, you got to answer me one question for me. I said, where was Lincoln shot? And yeah, the joke is, of course, it's Ford's Theater. But no, where physically was Lincoln shot? And Doug got it exactly right. Doug immediately goes, well, he was shot directly behind the left ear, and the ball traveled from the left to the right across the brain matter and lodged behind Lincoln's right eye. And I said, yeah, that's exactly right. Good job. That's not where he shot in this series. He shot behind the right ear. And it's just at the beginning of the series, it was this little thing that made me go, oh, come on, man. So there you go.
So, Tanisha, I think some of this, so not that part, but the part that came before it, answers a little bit of your question. That to your, I guess this is sort of a grisly way to put it now after what he just said, but you pointed out, I think, before the show that Lincoln was not throwing away his shot, that this was sort of a moment. And I think Matt is kind of fleshing that out for you. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're right. And Matt, I appreciate like all the history. I would sit at your feet and hear more and more and more, because I think, you know, we now in retrospect want to paint the story of that president, the 16th president, as the great emancipator. But he, my understanding, and again, I would always look to you to correct me where I'm wrong, is that he was going to make whatever deal he needed to make to be the kind of hero he imagined himself to be. And, you know, even the Frederick Douglass, you know, aspects, I was very curious about Frederick Douglass sort of being in the West Wing in that way. And I know, yes, Frederick Douglass was there, but, you know, was this Black man truly helping to determine the future of Black people in America? You know, you made a point, Zandra, about Mary Todd Lincoln and her shopping. You know, there is a play whose title escapes me in this moment that talks very much about the relationship between Elizabeth Keckley and Mary Todd Lincoln. And yes, you know, the benefit of that were these dresses, but that was a way to keep this woman close, right? And a lot of the relationship after Lincoln dies is, what will happen to me? What will happen to me now that, you know, the thing that was keeping us together was capitalism, was this relationship of you know, making her dresses. But that, you know, our understanding is that, like many relationships between Black people and white people at that time, yes, it was rooted in capitalism, yes, it was rooted in the economy of the time, but that there were real relationships that came out of that. So I mean, I said a lot of things in response to your very specific question, Colin. Yes, I don't think Lincoln was going to throw away his shot by completely emancipating Black people. I am curious about his relationship to the Black people that were in his life. And I think that this work does an interesting thing of showing us some of the ways in which interracial relationships existed in this time.
So, Zandra, we're almost out of time. Got a little bit more than a minute left at tops. But you mentioned hamminess, and one name we haven't said so far is the name of the actor who plays John Wilkes Booth, Anthony Boyle. He's almost arguably a co-star in this with Tobias Menzies. And it's a complicated thing, too, because John Wilkes Booth himself was a ham. I'm wondering what you think of the performance Boyle, an actor from Northern Ireland, is giving as Booth.
I actually thought that this performance was really interesting. I, as is probably clear, did not know a ton about this story, and I certainly didn't know a ton about John Wilkes Booth. And the notion that his entire identity is driven by his desire to be famous and by his desire to be a star, I thought really rang true in this performance. His performance definitely was hammy, but I felt like that was very much a part of the role. I do want to just call out one other name that I found very, very surprising in this show, which was Matt Walsh of Veep fame, and for me, of Dancing with the Stars fame, who plays the doctor who treats John Wilkes Booth, who is like one of the scariest characters in the show, like just a horrible, terrifying man. And watching him in this role was so profoundly jarring. I almost was completely drawn out of it every time I saw him come across the screen. I was like, that was the guy who was eliminated first last season of Dancing with the Stars.
Right. We have to stop there. There's so much more to say, including about Dancing with the Stars and how Edward Stanton would have done in it. But we'll have to stop. Thanks very much to this terrific panel. So great to have Matt Warschauer back with us. And I'll be back in a couple of seconds. Joking,
talking about this. And talking about that, and talk about everything as a matter of fact.
Torrington, Vernon, Danbury, Waterbury, Oliveberry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain, Vernon, I already said that one, Avon, Farmington, yeah, 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 yeah.
No longer ready.